From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about Osama bin Laden with Peter Bergen, author of a new biography, which also profiles bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. Bergen is CNN's terrorism analyst. He and Peter Arnett interviewed bin Laden in 1997. News videos and still photographs have left us with unforgettable images of the terrorist attacks. We'll talk to the woman who was pictured in one of the most famous photos from the war in Vietnam. Kim Phuc was 9 years old when she was photographed, screaming in pain, running naked down a road, her clothes burned off by napalm. Also, reviews of new CDs by the rock band The Strokes and jazz composer and saxophonist Henry Threadgill. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. 8 foreign aid workers, including 2 Americans, have been freed by the Taliban in Afghanistan. They are now en route to Pakistan. The 8 workers are employees of the German-based Christian organization Shelter Now International. They've been held since August 3rd on charges of trying to convert Muslims. Along with the 2 Americans are 4 Germans and 2 Australians. Anti-Taliban forces reportedly have taken control of another city in Afghanistan and are said to be fighting around the Taliban stronghold of Kandahar. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The Taliban reportedly has lost control of the eastern city of Jalalabad and is on the defensive in its own southern base of Kandahar. The opposition is no longer limited to the Northern Alliance, which seized control of the Afghan capital this week. A Pentagon spokesman, John Stuffelbeam, says nearly 2 dozen tribes drawn from southern Afghanistan's Pashtun ethnic group are now fighting against the Taliban.
Whether or not they're working in concert, we don't know. Whether or not they're being organized, all we know is that there are multiple groups now in opposition to the Taliban.
Stuffelbeam warns, however, it's too soon to conclude the Taliban is collapsing. He says U.S. military forces will continue searching for Taliban and al-Qaeda leaders. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
In Pakistan, there's growing concern over the Northern Alliance's capture of the Afghan capital, Kabul. NPR's Michael Sullivan is in Islamabad.
A Pakistan foreign ministry spokesman today said that a multinational force should be sent to Kabul immediately to provide security and, in his words, ensure that no single group occupies the capital. Spokesman Aziz Ahmed Khan said that the international community needs to speed up its efforts to ensure that a broad-based, multi-ethnic government be set up in Afghanistan, and soon, if the country is to avoid yet another civil war. UN envoy to Afghanistan, Francis Vendrell, is in Islamabad waiting to travel to Kabul for talks with Northern Alliance leaders. U.S. diplomat James Dobbins is also in Islamabad for talks regarding any future political setup. He too may travel to Kabul with a message for the Northern Alliance to make good on its pledge to share power. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Islamabad.
Crash investigators say they're getting information from the damaged flight data recorder from American Airlines Flight 587. It could offer clues about why the jet's tail fin tore away shortly after takeoff. The voice recorder shows that pilots began losing control of the plane within seconds of hearing 2 rattling noises. Air turbulence is being considered as a possible cause. All 260 people on board were killed, along with 5 people on the ground. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 72 points to finish at 98.23. The Nasdaq Composite Index was up 11 points, finishing at 19.03. The S&P 500 was up 2. This is NPR News. In Chicago, DNA test results are raising doubts about the guilt of 4 men convicted in a 15-year-old rape and murder case. Court-ordered DNA testing shows no link between the 4 men and evidence found on the clothing of a medical student who was murdered in 1986. From Chicago, NPR's Greg Allen reports.
Lori Rossetti was found dead 15 years ago, raped and murdered after an evening spent studying at Rush University Medical School in Chicago, where she was a student. 3 months later, police arrested 4 men whom they said ambushed Rossetti as she was on her way home. Based on their confessions and testimony by a Chicago police crime analyst, the 4 were convicted, and 3 of them received life sentences. But a DNA expert hired by the defense says the testimony offered by the police crime analyst was, quote, scientific fraud, and tests conducted by the defense found no link between the 4 men and DNA evidence found on the victim's clothing. A court ordered more extensive DNA tests, and those tests have now also proved negative. An attorney who represents the men says based on the evidence, she's hopeful that her clients will be released as early as next month. Officials with the Illinois State Attorney's Office are not commenting on the finding. Greg Allen, NPR News, Chicago.
The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee today questioned the decision by the Bush administration to order military tribunals for foreigners accused of terrorism. In a statement, Democrat Patrick Leahy said the executive order signed yesterday sends a message to the world that it is acceptable to hold secret trials and summary executions. The statement questions whether the order would make it less likely for other countries to assist in the arrest and extradition of suspected terrorists. Repeating the hour's top story, 8 foreign aid workers have been released by the Taliban in Afghanistan. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Association of Fundraising Professionals, increasing awareness of the needs of the world's charities. November 15th is National Philanthropy Day, afpnet.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Peter Bergen has written a new book about Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda network called Holy War, Inc. Bergen is CNN's terrorism analyst. He and Peter Arnett interviewed Osama bin Laden for CNN in 1997, the year after bin Laden issued his first call to Muslims to attack U.S. military targets. In 1983, after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, Bergen made a documentary about the millions of Afghan refugees crossing the border into Pakistan. In 1993, he traveled to Afghanistan to explore the links between the Mujahideen, the CIA-funded Afghan rebels who fought the Soviets, and the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. I asked Peter Bergen what he thinks the Northern Alliance's victories in Mazar-i-Sharif and Kabul will mean for bin Laden.
Well, it can't be good news for bin Laden, right? I mean, the advance of the Northern Alliance was rather swift. And, I've interviewed Hakman Shah Massoud, the now dead leader of the Northern Alliance. I've also interviewed Dr. Abdullah, the foreign minister of the alliance. And they both had very much the same views about bin Laden and the Afghan Arabs, his followers in general. Even in the early 90s, Massoud was saying, we don't need these Arabs in Afghanistan. They did their job in the holy war against the Soviet Union during the 80s. Their services are no longer required. We want them to leave. And Dr. Abdullah, I interviewed about a year ago, and he was he regards bin Laden as a deathly threat. And of course, the Northern Alliance has been, because bin Laden and the Taliban were fighting together, the Northern Alliance has had a strong interest in bin Laden and his Arab fighters. And clearly, they are very much opposed. How quickly the fact that they've taken Kabul and how quickly that means, perhaps the death or the capture of bin Laden, I think that's still a long way off.
The Pakistani journalist Hamid Mir recently interviewed bin Laden, and Hamid Mir says that bin Laden said that he has nuclear and chemical weapons that he could use to retaliate against the United States if we used such weapons against him. What information do you have about the nuclear or chemical weapons that Al-Qaeda may have?
Let me review briefly what bin Laden has done in the past. We know that bin Laden's group was willing to pay $1.5 million for a bomb-grade uranium when the group was based in Sudan in the mid-90s. It's not clear if that transaction ever happened, but they made very serious inquiries together with the Sudanese military to buy this stuff. Secondly, bin Laden has repeatedly said that it's not a crime for Muslims to acquire these kinds of weapons. And then we've seen him saying that he does have this kind of capability. Also, you think about where Afghanistan is in the world. It's just south of the former republics of the republics of the former Soviet Union. With a lot of leaky reactors there, a lot of scientists who are not being paid, it's quite possible that nuclear material might have gone to bin Laden. I know from my own reporting on the subject, which I detail somewhat in my book, that in 1997 I was approached by an Afghan through an intermediary who said that he had nuclear materials for sale. I was doing a story on the whole question of the former Soviet Union and the nuclear materials that might be coming from there. They gave me some serial numbers on the container that was supposed to contain this material. The serial numbers didn't check out. It was apparently a hoax. But nonetheless, whatever this Afghan was selling was causing him health problems, according to the intermediary. So there's plenty of uranium waste, or like even hospital waste, which has uranium content, which is floating around in that part of the world. So I think it would be wishful thinking of the First Order to assume that he doesn't have some kind of capability. Now, of course, to make a nuclear weapon, you know, nation states spend hundreds of millions of dollars and have huge cadres of scientists trying to create nuclear weapons. States like Iraq still don't have stuff that could be effectively weaponized. So the notion that he has a nuclear weapon, I think, is unlikely. What he certainly has, in my view, and it'd be, I think you'd have to be very, very, very naive to assume he doesn't, is some ability to create what's known as a dirty nuclear bomb, which is basically a truck bomb with some sort of low-level nuclear waste. It's not a weapon that would kill a lot of people, but if you blew up that kind of thing, it would disperse over a wide area. It would be certainly a very effective terror weapon. And to go into your question on chemical weapons, we also know that the group has experimented in kind of an amateur way with chemical weapons. As recently as 2 or 3 years ago, the members of Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden's organization, were injecting, in one of the training camps, were injecting dogs with cyanide. They were taking dogs and putting them into containers with cyanide gas and sulfuric acid. Obviously, the dogs died. The idea, according to the testimony of somebody who was in those camps, is that the cyanide gas would be introduced into the air intake of U.S. government buildings. So, again, you've seen a sort of amateur attempt to use these weapons. You'll remember Amsham Rikyo, which was the Japanese sort of cult. They had tens of millions of dollars and a whole cadre of scientists experimenting with chemical weapons. When they actually deployed sarin gas in the Tokyo subway station some years ago, they only killed a few people. So it's very, Bin Laden doesn't have a sort of cave in Afghanistan with hundreds of scientists working on these things. I think they have some capability. I don't think it's enormous.
You know, the way I read his response to Hamid Mir about nuclear and chemical weapons is that, you know, his group has weapons like that that they could use in retaliation if we use them against him. Is it your interpretation that he's saying he has these weapons, but he'd only use them if we use them first?
Well, that's what the interview appears to say. But I sort of think with Bin Laden, to a certain extent, all bets are off. One of the disturbing things about the videotape that first surfaced on October 7th, the night of the aerial assaults, the first aerial assaults by the United States against Afghanistan, Bin Laden references, not for the first time and nor the last time, about how America has used nuclear weapons and killed hundreds of thousands of civilians. Since Bin Laden's statements have tended to be the best guide to his actions, this is kind of a disturbing statement in the context of only a 6-minute videotape. To me, it seems that, the worst-case scenario, and I think after the events of September 11th, you don't have to be alarmist to take the worst-case scenario, is that Bin Laden has something up his sleeve. And the fact that he's referencing these kinds of, in his view, you know, the United States has killed a lot of civilians, therefore he can do whatever he wants. If indeed he does have this kind of dirty nuclear weapon, I'm afraid to say that it's well within his. I think it's well within the modus operandi of the group to deploy it at a certain point. I'm not saying in this country, but I'm saying perhaps against an American target in some other country around the world.
Do you think that Bin Laden is behind the anthrax attacks, or do you think that that has a chance of being American homegrown terrorism?
The most disturbing aspect of the anthrax story is that nobody has a clue. You know, I mean, the United States government is sort of on the record in a lot of different ways, basically saying we just don't know, and that's true. That's true today. Bin Laden had the opportunity, by the way, this past weekend, to say that he had some biological capacity, and he didn't mention it. So
he just mentioned nuclear and chemical.
That's correct. So to me, that was a significant omission. You know, weaponizing anthrax to the degree that it apparently was in the instances we've seen is again the act of you have to have a pretty sophisticated lab. So I mean, I think the jury is very much out. Although the only thing we can add to the to what's known is, I think Bin Laden's own statements, this omission of the biological component, I think was significant because he had an opportunity to say that and he didn't.
The Bush administration asked TV stations not to run over and over the tapes that Bin Laden makes, in which he or a spokesperson speaks. And the reason why was that there might be secret messages somehow encoded into the video. Do you know of any secret messages that have ever been encoded into a video?
I don't. And the thing that struck me as odd about that is, I mean, it seems to me the message is very uncoded. It's go and kill Americans. I mean, it's pretty obvious what the message is anyway. But I'm not aware that he may communicate like that, but I think it's much more general than that. I mean, it's not necessary. People already understand what if they're part of the group, that's what you're supposed to be doing anyway. And I don't, it's very hard for me to comment because they say that, but there's really no proof either way. It's certainly never come up as a, for instance, in the embassy bombing trial, there were, tens and tens and thousands of pages of court filings, and there was no indication of that was the way that he communicated.
My guest is CNN's terrorism analyst, Peter Bergen. His new biography of bin Laden is called Holy War, Inc. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Peter Bergen is my guest. He's the terrorism analyst for CNN and author of the new book, Holy War, Inc., Inside the Secret World of Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden is the son of Mohammed bin Laden, and Mohammed bin Laden is the founder of a very successful construction company in Saudi Arabia. The family renovated the two holy shrines of Mecca and Medina, and I believe they renovated the royal palace as well. Now, Osama bin Laden's father, Mohammed bin Laden, died in a plane crash when Osama was 10 years old. I just find it very interesting that Osama bin Laden is behind using passenger planes as weapons and has promised that the storm from the skies would continue. And meanwhile, his father was killed in a plane crash. I'm not sure what that means, but there's some kind of... there seems to be something going on there. Yeah?
But Osama's father died in a plane crash, and then his oldest brother, Salem, who died in a plane crash actually in Texas in 1988, and he was piloting an ultralight plane which hit some power lines. So both his father and then his older brother die in the plane crashes. And of course, there are, these plane hijackings. I mean, I'm not sure what it means either, but it's a sort of theme. And also destroying buildings is also a theme. I mean, here's a man who he spends much of his life, building. His father builds up this huge company, which is in the construction business. And then bin Laden spends a lot of his life demolishing various buildings. Again, I'm not sure what it means, but it is a theme running through his life.
Where does Osama bin Laden fit into the bin Laden family? We know a little bit about his father. What do you know about his mother?
Well, he's very close to his mother still. His mother visited him as recently as would have been earlier. But one of bin Laden's son was married earlier this year, and bin Laden's mother, who is Syrian, was actually at the wedding. So they keep in fairly close contact. And bin Laden's mother also visited him when he was living in Sudan in the mid-90s. So his mother, I've heard from people who are allowed to talk. The family, by the way, is very hard to talk to. But somebody sort of authorized to speak to me said, look, the family doesn't consider her part of the family. She was divorced from Osama's father a long time ago. Osama's father had many wives. You're only allowed four at once under Islam, but he had more than that, although he kept to the notion of only keeping four at once. But, bin Laden is the only son of this particular mother. He has two full sisters. So the family is a large one. There are several hundred members at this point. I mean, I take them as sort of at their word when they say that we reject bin Laden and he's the sort of effectively the black sheep of the family. But, with such a large family, they're clearly sort of competing interests. And I think it's generally the view that certain elements of the family continue to support him both morally and perhaps even financially.
The bin Laden family business, and this isn't Osama bin Laden, this is the other members of the family, they're involved in many, many businesses. Just give us a sense of what the bin Laden group has made its money on.
Well, principally, it's construction. And if you look at some of the things they've done, I mean, they're rebuilding airports in Cairo and Aden and Yemen. They're building Hyatts in, I think, Kuala Lumpur. These are huge construction projects. They're hotels, they're renovating airports there. But they moved beyond that core construction business into, they diversified into pretty much, an unbelievable number of other things. I mean, And one of the family members said that, you know, they have an interest in the Hard Rock Cafe in the Middle East. They don't take money from any drink alcohol profits, but they do have an interest in that. By their own description on their website, which is now down, they had the license for Snapple drinks in the Middle East. They also had Volkswagen, Porsche, a whole, you know, even Disney. They had some rights to turn Disney features into Arabic. Telecommunications, Motorola had a ultimately ill-fated venture to set up something called the Iridium system, which was 66 satellites around the world. You could make a phone call anywhere in the world with a handheld phone. One of Bin Laden's brothers sits on the board. And, you know, it even extends to the United States. One of Salim Bin Laden, who is Osama's oldest brother, made his business partner in the United States was a man by the name of James Barth, a Houston entrepreneur who bought various pieces of Houston real estate for Salim Bin Laden. And this man, James Barth, is actually a friend of President George Bush from his time when they were both in the Texas National Guard in the 60s. So, I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, it's just interesting. There's 6 degrees of separation there between the president and Osama bin Laden. But it shows the extent of where this company has, you know, real estate in Texas and New Jersey. It's a very big company.
How was bin Laden radicalized, and who were his mentors?
Well, bin Laden has said that his father said that one of his sons would fight against the enemies of Islam. And in bin Laden's view, he's the one son that is doing that. And it's interesting that bin Laden has been influenced by a number of older, religiously radical men, principally Abdullah Azzam, who was a very well-known Islamic scholar who sort of created the first international modern jihadist network, if you will. He was the guy who was bin Laden's sort of senior colleague in the effort to recruit Muslims from around the world to come and fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan during the 80s. So Abdullah Azzam was an important mentor. And then number two is the person that we've seen step into the limelight a little bit recently is Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is a apparently quite skilled surgeon who comes from a rather prominent Egyptian family. He has been basically a sort of revolutionary stroke terrorist since 1973 when he founded Egypt's jihad group, which has been very narrowly devoted to trying to overthrow the Egyptian state. That group was involved in the assassination of President Anwar Sadat in 1981. And Ayman al-Zawahiri identified the United States as an enemy apparently quite early on. He has had a critical role in terms of influencing bin Laden. I talked to many, many different people who all said the same thing. Ayman al-Zawahiri is, you know, they use words like brain. You know, he's in Osama bin Laden's brain or his mind. Certainly, Ayman al-Zawahiri's had a very important role to play. And it's interesting that, you know, just after the events of September 11th, Ayman al-Zawahiri appeared on the video with bin Laden and really for the first time spoke to the world. And I think up hitherto was a pretty unknown figure.
You say that al-Zawahiri seems to be the brains behind the operation. From the little that you've spoken to bin Laden and the much that you've heard and read about him, do you think he's smart?
I think he's smart. I mean, I thought that on September 10th. I mean, he you know, his range of references in these various statements he makes, he's clearly well-read and somewhat well-read in Islamic history. He's not a religious scholar in the strict Islamic sense of the word, but he's certainly, you know, a bright guy. My concern is that he has some game plan beyond what we've seen already, because the actions that we've seen so far suggest an understanding of what was going to happen. I mean, first of all, the assassination of Ahmad Shah Massoud, the most effective anti-Taliban leader. There's no natural leader of the Northern Alliance right now with the absence of Massoud, and that was clearly an assassination attempt engineered by bin Laden, I think. And then secondly, the fact that he has all these videotapes ready suggests that he also understood that there was going to be a propaganda element to this war and he needed to get his message out. The question is, has he thought through, you know, is the fall of Kabul a huge surprise to him? I mean, it was a surprise to everybody else that it happened so quickly. But I do think that he has a game plan beyond where we are right now.
Do you have any idea how close Osama bin Laden is with Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban?
I think they're definitely close, but there's been a lot of misreporting about, there was a widely circulated rumor that they were somehow related by marriage, and I talked to a number of Taliban cabinet officials, and they all universally said that was not true. And in fact, bin Laden just this past weekend was asked that same question directly, and he also said it was not the case. But he is very close to Mullah Omar, but I think it's very important to understand Mullah Omar has the ability to end this war tomorrow, because bin Laden has sworn a bayat, which is an oath of allegiance to Mullah Omar. And on a video that was circulating this summer, he very exactly refers to Mullah Omar. Bin Laden refers to Mullah Omar as a commander of the faithful, which is an important title, suggesting that bin Laden really looks to Mullah Omar as sort of the leader. And so I think that Mullah Omar could turn bin Laden over if he wanted to. I don't think it's very likely, for several reasons. One, bin Laden has contributed men and money to the Taliban cause. Two, they're ideologically similar and obviously quite close personally. And three, there is a very important concept. The Pashtuns, who are the Taliban, they make up the majority of the Taliban, subscribe to something called Pashtun Wali, which is a tribal code of conduct, which puts enormous premium on the concepts of giving hospitality to people, and also giving refuge to the people who seek your refuge. And that's, a Taliban official said this interesting anecdote to me. He said, look, during World War II, there were a number of Germans who were in Afghanistan, and the Allies were very keen for them to be handed over. They were non-Muslims, and we didn't turn them over. So, we're not going to turn over bin Laden. He's our guest, we admire him, etc. Now, maybe that'll change if there is a sort of spectacular Taliban defeat. But I think there's going to be an element of the Taliban that's going to continue fighting to the end. The Taliban was never a monolithic movement. It was made up of former communists, people who switched sides when they saw the tide was going in the Taliban's favor, who will switch back. But nonetheless, there is this hardcore, I think, that I don't think surrender is part of their vocabulary.
Well, Peter Bergen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Bergen is CNN's terrorism analyst. His new biography of bin Laden is called Holy War, Inc. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Elektra Entertainment, whose releases include Natalie Merchant's new album, Motherland. Natalie-Merchant.com or AOL keyword Natalie Merchant. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a review of Henry Threadgill's new CD. We're listening to it now. Also, we talk with the subject of one of the most famous photos from the war in Vietnam. Kim Phuc was 9 when she was photographed during a napalm attack as she ran down a road naked, screaming in pain. And we have a review of a new CD by The Strokes. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Composer, saxophonist, and flutist Henry Threadgill is one of the most cosmopolitan of musicians, dividing his time between New York and Goa, India, working on projects in Europe, and populating his bands with players from diverse stylistic backgrounds. Threadgill has two new recordings, one from his new sextet called Zuid, which includes members from Morocco, Cuba, and Puerto Rico, as well as the U.S. mainland. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review. He says even by Threadgill's standards, Zuid is a step forward and maybe just what the world needs.
Some chronologies of jazz begin not when the music gelled 100 years ago, but with the Moorish invasion of Spain in the 8th century. Arabs and Berbers brought to Europe ideas about art common to the Islamic world from Tangier to Turkey. A love of stylization and ornamentation, of riffing and paraphrase and repeatable forms, stuff jazz uses every day. Americans are not so sensitive to such deep influences, but they do surface in jazz occasionally. Miles Davis touched on Moorish roots on his classic Sketches of Spain. John Coltrane once recorded with Sudanese-American Ahmed Abdul-Malik on oud, the short-necked Mideastern lute. The oud also turns up as part of a string trio in Henry Threadgill's sextet, Zuid. Henry Threadgill on alto flute, with Tariq Ben-Brahim from Morocco on oud, Liberty Elman on acoustic guitar, and Dana Leong on plucked cello. They sound very good together. In medieval Spain, the oud had evolved into the guitar, an instrument whose vocabulary influences the cello's role in improvised music now. By putting all three in one band, Threadgill connects 1,400 years of music history. That's a big gulp even for a composer fond of bringing the past into the musical present. Threadgill often laces his music with the tuba and march rhythms that early jazz inherited from military bands. But then marching bands got their big impetus from an 18th century European composer's fad for Turkish music. The percussion set those composers called for was a first step toward the modern drum kit. Cuban-born drummer Daphnis Prieto is a font of funky grooves, pushing the band while Jose Davila's lumbering tuba pulls the other way. Between the two, the band moves at a likable shamble. Threadgill doesn't write many catchy tunes, but they have a distinctive character. His slow ones mix the floating quality and open-ended feel of music from India with wide melodic leaps out of 20th century classical music. But Threadgill never references a culture or style without hearing how it all fits together. He's not on a scavenger hunt. Threadgill's new CD with Zuid, Up Pop the Two Lips on Pi Records, reminds us how smart music can reflect the cultural and historical forces that shape its time. This feels like 21st century music. It's as if Threadgill has built a transparent model of the world where you can see layers of artifacts under the surface on all sides of the globe and see how it all connects. This stuff is good because it sounds good, but it also depicts a world where cultural strains are so intermingled, there's no us and them anymore. We are all us.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Up Popped the Two Lips by Henry Threadgill and his sextet Zooid. Coming up, we meet the girl, now a woman, in one of the most famous photos from the war in Vietnam. This is Fresh Air. Americans who weren't eyewitnesses to the attacks of September 11th share a collective visual memory of the attacks through news videos and still photographs. We're going to hear from a woman who was the subject of one of the most famous photos from the war in Vietnam, a picture that shaped Americans' image of the war. Kim Phuc was 9 years old in 1972 when she was photographed during a napalm attack, running naked down a road, screaming in pain. The napalm had burned the clothes off her body. Phuc prefers to look at a more recent photo of herself, one in which she is holding her son Thomas on his first birthday. This photo appears in the book Family, A Celebration of Humanity. It's part of a trilogy of photo books from the MILK collection, an acronym for Moments of Intimacy, Laughter, and Kinship. Phuc wrote the prologue to the volume titled Love. A companion exhibition was shown in New York last summer and is now touring European cities. I asked Kim Phuc when she first saw the now famous 1972 photograph.
I remember when I came back from the hospital after years, and my parents, they have the picture. They cut it from the newspaper, so they kept very well, and then they show me, they took the picture when you're running out from the fire.
Now, you're naked in the picture. Is that because the clothes were burned off you from the napalm?
Yes. I was in the middle of the people, so I got hit directly from the napalm.
What actually happened that day? Let's start with who you were at that time, where you lived, what kind of work your parents did, how many people were in your family.
Normally, before the war came into my village, we had everything. And I just finished my grade 3, and I have a summertime. And then it's in June, I know that the war came into my village. And so we didn't know where we have to go. So finally, we decided to hide in the temple nearby my house with another villager. And then we hide in the temple about 3 days. And on the third day, they dropped the napalm. And so before that moment, we just finished our lunch. And then we suddenly we saw the color mark they dropped inside the temple area. Is that signal indicated the temple was going to be bombed. So the soldier that stayed with us, and they scream and they say, we have to go out, run. And they ask the children running first. And I am the one of them. And I remember when I ran out of the temple, just in the front of the temple, and I saw the airplane and I saw 4 bombs, and suddenly I just saw the fire everywhere around me. I saw the fire over my body, and my clothes just burned off. And I was so scared, and I screaming, and I just ran out of that fire. That has happened.
When you were running from the bombs and you saw fire over your body and realized that your clothes had been burned off your body, what went through your mind? What was your comprehension of what was happening to you at that moment?
Yes, I remember because I was 9 years old. And I remember at that moment when I saw the fire over my body, I said, oh my goodness, I got burned. So I would be ugly and the people, they can see me different way. I'm not normal anymore. And so I stopped thinking about that because I was so scared. And I didn't see anybody around me. But then, like, naturally, I just run out of that. And I thank God that my feet weren't burned, so I could able to run out.
How did you get to the hospital?
After I got burned, and so I ran out of the fire, and I kept running and running, and I saw my cousin. And so we kept running and running until I saw so many people in the front of me, and I stopped, and I felt so tired to run anymore. So I stopped, and I feel so pain and thirsty. And so I saw some soldier. They stayed around me, and I say, "Nóng quá, nóng quá." It means too hot, too hot. And he gave me some water to drink, and he poured the water over my body. He just tried to help me.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, when he poured the water over me, it means it cooked more.
Why? And why did it cook more?
Because it's when I got burned too hot, and with hot water, in there is reaction is cook more.
Wow.
Yeah, and then that's why the pain at that moment was so terrible. So I lost my consciousness and I didn't know anything else. But then I learned that Nick Wood, the photographer, he took me to a nearest hospital. He saved my life.
I wonder if you talk to him about why he saved your life. I mean, there are some photographers who, knowing that they were under deadline, would rush their film to get it mailed to their newspaper or to get it sent in whatever transmission form they were using to their newspaper instead of taking the time to rush a victim to the hospital like he did with you.
That's why I'm always, I'm so grateful to him because he's not only doing his job like photographer, but he helping me like a human being helping to another. And so that's why I'm always so grateful. And I call him like my uncle. I call him Uncle Ut all the time. And yeah,
it's
so amazing.
How often are you in touch with him?
We almost, he called me all the time, every week. we just very close, yeah.
What was the extent of the burns on your body?
I got, in total, in my body, just 65%. Burn, but I had 35% to do skin graft.
Did you think you were going to die?
Yes, I did. I almost died, but I thank God I'm still alive because of that picture. A lot of people, they recognize I am that little girl, and I receive a lot of help from the doctor, from the foundation. Like I was in the hospital after that. Wow, it's too long. It's about 14 months, and I got 17 operations in total to repair the third degree burns over half of my body.
So you think that you got special treatment because of the photograph?
Yes, I think that, yes.
When did you realize that the photograph was taking on the symbolic value that the photograph had come to represent, the damage of the war in Vietnam and how innocent people were just being killed and wounded and mutilated?
10 years later, when I growing up, and in 1992, the Vietnamese government, they found me. I am that little girl. So that moment, I realized that a lot of people, they pay attention, and I know that is my pictures are really the symbol of war.
There are several other people in the photo, several other children, and about three soldiers running behind you. Who are the other people in the picture?
Two boys in the right hand is my brothers, and two children in the left hand is my cousins. They are a sister and brother.
What has happened to them?
They got a minor burn because they run in just a little bit faster than me. So they got the napalm that is finished fire, and then is the rest of the napalm just stick in their clothes, but not burn, right? And so they got the minor burn, and they get better after a few months later. And they're living in Vietnam right now.
Do you still have a lot of physical pain?
Yes, I do. But I change the behavior. You know, I never thought and I never focus in the pain. I just massage, put cream on, and do something else, or like go out for a walk, and sing a song, and I think that just let it go. I never concentrate on the pain. And so that is helpful, because I learned that before, when I thinking about the pain, just get bigger and bigger and bigger, never help. So I change it.
Would you describe the recent photo of you that's in the current exhibition?
I think that everyone, most of you know about the picture in 1972, and I'm sure everyone see that picture, and they have the question, what happened to that little girl? How she is? And that is question all the time. And so that the answer right now is the second picture. The picture that I hold my son, Thomas, on his first birthday, and that is a picture of love, and that a picture that is mean like I can hold my own son, and I can hold my future, my hope, and that is my dream come true, because when I got burned and I grew up. And I feel like I never have a boyfriend, and I never get married. Even I never have a baby. But now I can have that picture. I feel so happy. And that picture is a picture of love. Yeah.
Were you afraid that because of the emotional and physical scars that you'd never get married?
That's right.
How much of your body is scarred?
I got like 35%. I have to do skin graft. Mm. Yes, and so it's so much scar on my body.
Is it mostly in places that you can cover up with clothes?
Yes. I just praise the Lord. that I can cover, yeah. And people, they can see my face and my hands is just normally, so is a really blessing. And so when I hold my son Thomas in that picture of of my friend Anne Bynum, she took it in Toronto. So you can see that is compare with my scar on my body, with his skin is so perfect, you know, and I'm so happy.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Kim Fook, the recent photo of her with her son on his first birthday, is included in the book Family, A Celebration of Humanity, part of a 3-volume collection of photos. She wrote the introduction for the volume titled Love. Since 1997, she's been a goodwill ambassador for peace for UNESCO. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by The Strokes. This is Fresh Air. Britney Spears and Michael Jackson may have new albums, but there's a new rock act that's getting a lot of media buzz. The Strokes is a New York quintet who were first seized upon as rock and roll saviors by the British press. Their debut CD is called Is This It? And rock critic Ken Tucker listened to hear whether it was.
Julian Casablancas sings in a world-weary voice that sounds vaguely muffled, as if it's wafting up from beneath a New York City manhole cover. Behind him, guitarist Albert Hammond Jr. provides riffs that are angular and razor-edged. You have to listen hard to hear any influence from his father, who had a top five hit in 1972 with the gloppy ballad It Never Rains in Southern California. Other influences, however, the band reveals openly. You can tell on a song such as The Modern Age that the Strokes have listened long and hard to the ultimate New York rock band, the Velvet Underground, with Casablancas doing a choice Lou Reed impersonation. Of course, impersonation does not a great rock band make, but it helps if you pick the right influences. What the Strokes have going for them is the lurching energy that characterized the other great Manhattan rock band, the New York Dolls, as well as a knack for catchy melodies that get your head bobbing to the music before you even take in what they're singing about.
Down.
That song is called Barely Legal, which suggests it's about underage lust, but these guys are too canny to court such controversy. Indeed, before releasing this album, they removed a song called New York City Cops, in which the police were referred to as not being very smart. A small insult in the scheme of things, but one they aren't about to risk right now. At any rate, Barely Legal actually plays out as a wistful song about losing one's innocence and mourning it. At their best, though, the Strokes are a lot more interesting for the way they manage to sound jaded and enthusiastic simultaneously, a terrific contradiction that comes together most enjoyably on Last Night. Last night. Overall, there's something too derivative about the Strokes' music to make even its biggest fans, among whom they can count Elton John, to justify their next big thing status. But I'm really glad so raucous and artfully slapdash a band as the Strokes can get the attention they've gotten. Because in the midst of tidy teen pop and growling pessimistic hip-hop, it means there's still space for five guys to hammer at a couple of guitar chords, slam on a set of drums, and yell about things in a way that makes some listeners' hearts flutter with exhilaration.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Is This It by The Strokes. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Schurach. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. And the National Endowment for the Arts. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House. Publisher of Sometimes I Dream in Italian by Rita Cerisi, a novel of sisters by the author of Pink Slip. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York City Police Commissioner Bernard Carrick about his experiences on September 11th and what it's like to protect a city in a constant state of high alert. Carrick has written a new memoir. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.